Welcome back to Booked Up. Just a reminder, we are trying something new here. What we are doing is the opposite of an interview. It should feel like the conversation you have when you run into an old friend at a coffee shop and you have some time to kill. So you sit down and dive right in to find out how you're really doing, what's going on in their lives, and we're just catching up because it's been a while. Today, I'm sitting with my friend Michael Cohen, who is going to talk with me about his new book, Revenge, the recent guilty verdict in the case against his former boss, Donald Trump's business organizations, his own time at Otisville Prison, and Donald's terrible grades. Let's dive in. Hey, Michael.
How are you doing, Jen?
I am very good. Where are you?
I am home. I'm here in New York City, actually sitting in my dining room. It's the only place I can run away here in order to get some peace and quiet.
The dining room, because is the apartment filled with noisemakers or something?
Yeah, I have my two kids that are here. My son is at work, so he'll be home sometime later on. But my daughter is here and she's packing to leave on a vacation. Well, I shouldn't say, she's meeting up with some friends overseas.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah. How long will she be escaping?
4 or 5
Just
days.
Over the Christmas?
Four or five days. Really nice.
So it must be nice to be in your apartment without any kind of ankle bracelet or threat of return to Otisville or anything like that.
Well, you have to remember, I haven't had an ankle bracelet on now for about 2 years. You know, it's funny because whenever I have a disagreement with somebody on social media platforms, the first thing that they like to say is, shouldn't you be in prison? Listen to me, my friends. As I write to them, you know, I've been out now for 2 years should have been longer than that. I mean, I shouldn't have even gone in the first place. And obviously you saw what happened to Michael Avenatti, who is one of the protagonists in my case. We also saw what happened now to Alan Weisselberg, you know, who had lied to the Southern District in my case. And now we're seeing what happened to the Trump Organization as well. So,
yeah, let's go.
You know what we call that, Jen?
What?
Karma boomerang.
Oh, it feels like a lot of karma. Let's go through each of them. The first one, Michael Avenatti, who is right now sitting in prison, just got another sentence. What is it, 12 additional years?
No, I think it's 14.
Oh, 14. Wow.
It's 14 on top of the 5 that he got for the Nike Stormy Daniels matters.
So he cheats clients, he shakes down corporations with threats. Yeah, I have to tell you something, Michael. I was one of those people who thought he was a good guy when I first saw him. And when I read your book,
Jen,
that we're going to talk about.
Jen, I'm sorry. This conversation could end really, really quickly.
I'm being honest with you. And
by the way,
not
only you,
friends.
But the whole country. I mean, they embrace this clown, you know, this ass clown, as if he was the second coming, you know, of name your choice, that he was going to be the only one who could take on the likes of Donald Trump. He was going to even, the reason he was somewhat effective is because just like Donald, he's a narcissistic sociopath.
And he was filled with lies, and he really interjected himself in places where he shouldn't have and made things up and made things worse. And okay, so that's the first person. The second person you mentioned was Alan Weisselberg, who's supposed to get, how much is he supposed to get in Rikers? Was it 5 months?
5 months, but 5 months translates to 100 days.
Okay.
And look, while Rikers is an ugly place, and I'm sure it's not going to be easy for him, not that I care, but what he did and even some of the answers that he gave to the DA's office were deceptive at best. And that would have and could have potentially brought him to a 15-year sentence. But for whatever the reason is, the DA's office didn't want to challenge him on the lies. I mean, the notion that Alan Weisselberg, right, the CFO, former bookkeeper, non-CPA, is falling on the sword because he and Jeff McConney decided to do this on their own based out of greed. And so the notion that he was able to write a check or to do anything without Donald's explicit approval is pure. It's just pure nonsense.
Yeah, Just to remind listeners, although I'm sure they probably remember, what we're talking about is how Alan Weisselberg, the former CFO of the various Trump Organization businesses, had this summer pleaded guilty to charges of arranging under the table off-books payments that would benefit him and really the Trump Organization, things like getting getting for compensation, but off the books, an apartment, cars, and other things. And this, under the law, the state law crimes included things like tax evasion, business records evasion, some kinds of conspiracy, and so on. The latest news before you jump off of this topic,
how about the fact that they turned over to the district attorney for the investigation? I believe it's also in the hands of our unsinkable attorney general, Tish James. The second set of books that Donald kept that didn't even have these payments in them, which clearly shows the fraud. It also clearly shows that Donald had requisite knowledge of everything that was going on here. And the fact that, he hasn't been charged for alleged crime yet, right? The fact that there was this opportunity to have brought those charges against him, the ones that both Mark Pomerantz and Carrie Dunn, who were the two lead investigators in this case, ended up resigning under protest. So, look, Alvin Bragg is making, and there's a line that I was thinking of the other day, right? I mean, there he's out on television, and we'll call it Alvin bragging about the fact that they got the conviction on
right,
all
counts.
Right,
that's the part I want to say. This week, they got this conviction.
$1.6 million. So you know what Donald's already doing? He's already putting out there, they're killing me, they're going after me, patriots, friends, I need your help. Send me $500, $1,000, $5,000. It's unbelievable. So it's not like this is going to cost him anything.
So let's just make sure we put that in the center of this. So what happened this week was that a jury in New York state court found two Trump Organization businesses, the Trump Corporation and the Trump Payroll Corporation, which are organized under New York law, found them guilty of under 17 counts of these crimes that Weisselberg was involved in. He testified. And what you just said, Michael, is so important that in the complaint itself, as well as the testimony, it became clear that Donald was part of this, even though he wasn't charged. There's something in your book, Revenge, that you said deep into the book. You said you can't separate Trump from the Trump Organization, which brings us to sort of, you already talked about the past, how Alvin Bragg got cold feet at the beginning of 2022 and didn't add Donald to this case or bring another case against him. So what I'm wondering now, I'm so excited about this guilty verdict because I think this is a watershed. I think this is a turning point that will give Bragg and his new hire, this guy, Michael Colangelo, some courage.
Matthew Colangelo.
Sorry, I have your name. Matthew Colangelo.
You got Michael on the mind.
All the Michaels. Michael Avenatti, Michael Cohn. So Matthew Colangelo, do you think he's going to have the knowledge and the courage and the approval by Bragg to move forward against Donald on the stuff that you provided a lot of the information on, not just this small potatoes tax fraud, but the big tax, bank, and insurance fraud case that they were building?
You know what would have been really nice? You may remember when Tish James first filed the 220-page lawsuit against Donald.
September.
Right. And in her speech, she thanked me and she credited me for providing the information that led in part to the filing of this indictment, this lawsuit. It would have been nice if Alvin Bragg would have done the same because I had provided more than a dozen meetings. I was interviewed more than a dozen times with the DA's office, provided thousands of documents and so on. And, you know, it was hundreds of hours of, you know, of work in order to bring this case to where it is today. Now, that being said, it just would have been nice to have had an acknowledgement. But then again, you know, that's not generally how people, you know, react. All of a sudden there's a conviction and everybody jumps up onto center stage holding the gold medal, right? And so on.
Right.
$1.6 million to me is, as my grandmother would say, gunish magunish, nothing for nothing, right? In
gunish
Yiddish.
Magunish?
Yeah,
that's
in Yiddish.
Yiddish.
It means nothing for nothing. And
yeah,
it is nothing for nothing. Now we have to wait to see what he's going to do. I believe, like you, that Matthew Colangelo is brought on specifically to file the indictment and to try these cases for additional against additional defendants for additional crimes that were committed and maybe testimony that was given by Weisselberg or others in this case now spawn these new cases. Who knows? We'll see. But could you imagine if they don't, right? That would be twice Alvin Bragg had the opportunity to hold this guy accountable. I do also think that what this case really shows someone like Alvin Bragg, and certainly it shows Tish James, that in New York, despite the fact that we two are diverse, the Republicans and Democrats, and what's the chance that you're going to have a jury that is unanimous when it comes to Trump. There might be, you know, jurors that say, listen, I'm a big fan of his. They've been doing this to him since day one. I'm not going to convict him. You'd have a hung jury, you know, and then they would have to then start all over again. That's not what happened. It was unanimous. And I think that shows Alvin Bragg and others that Donald Trump can be held accountable for crimes that he committed if, in fact, the prosecutors are able to show, in this case, the standard, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt with, you know, clear and convincing evidence that he committed these crimes.
So I agree with you, and I want to two things. I don't want to get too far from the comments you made about your role, because I learned something new in reading Revenge about your cooperation, your voluntary cooperation with the Manhattan DA's office. You know, and how their investigation for a case they've not yet brought related to Donald Trump using his businesses and overvaluing real estate and other property and undervaluing it when it served his interests. And this is the case that Tish James brought civilly on behalf of the state of New York. But so far, the Manhattan DA, this is why Pomerantz and the others quit, because Alvin Bragg wasn't going to bring the case. But before we get too much into that investigation, it all started in early 2018, right, when you testified before Congress.
Before the House Oversight Committee. Yeah.
So I saw, you know, you talk in the book about a real kindness that Elijah Cummings paid you. And I mean, I was almost in tears because I remember when you testified and it sure looked like, I mean, you looked like you hadn't slept in a month. Like you looked, it was hard, you know, and you were treated really poorly by, several of the clown car Republicans, you know, with their immature tactics. And Cummings was so kind to you and treated you like a human being. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? And then I want to ask more about your cooperation, both in Otisville and after the many, many hours.
So it's interesting that that's the part that you bring up. That makes my eyes well up even right now. You may have, had tears in your eyes while you were reading it. I actually cried when I was writing that part. Elijah Cummings is a wonderful, wonderful human being. He is a man who showed me empathy when few people did. You know, and I acknowledge that every one of the Republicans that were there were, to be honest with you, they were fucking disgraceful individuals. They were horrific. The whole purpose that guided them, which was sent to them probably as talking points by Trump's team, was to denigrate me and to deflect anything away from Donald and on to me, which is why each and every one of them started out by saying, well, you're going to prison, right? You committed tax evasion. And there came a point even during that testimony where I said to one of the Republican members, you clearly didn't even read my sentencing memo. There was no tax evasion. I have never not filed a tax return in my life. In fact, I've never filed a late tax return. I've never been audited. I have never received a letter from the IRS stating that there was a problem. I've never had an overseas bank account nominee. All of this was in my sentencing memo. So many folks even today turn around and say, oh, well, you should have said this, you know, years ago, and you know, and you should have fought it. They don't understand what it's like when on a Friday at 5:30 p.m., somebody tells you, and it's your lawyer, at 5:30 p.m. that you have until Monday to plead guilty to whatever the prosecutors want, or they're filing an 80-page indictment that's going to include your wife, and that they're going to take both of you out of your apartment in handcuffs. I couldn't do that to my wife. And, you know, she wanted me to fight it. And I said, I can't risk you. She did, you know.
There was so much irregular about that and some other aspects of your case that they didn't even want to talk to you about your knowledge of what Donald Trump told you to do.
Look, Senator Dick Durbin actually was so furious about the whole scenario with the IRS. There, to this day, there isn't even an IRS agent that was assigned to my case. So, you know, where is there an IRS violation? How is a first-time offender with no cash business, with no overseas business, with no overseas banking account? I've never had an overseas bank account in my entire life. So what did I do? I put all my money in Capital One Bank, and my accountant fucked up. And instead of doing what he was supposed to do, which is reconcile the account, he messed up. And to get himself out of trouble there, though, you know, there really wouldn't have been any trouble. They must have offered him something else. But he then became a government witness to show them how he messed up, but blame it on me. It's really an amazing, But going back to Elijah, even after that hearing, he called me at night and he said to me, I just want to tell you that I'm thinking about you and your family and the country. And I just can't thank you enough for subjecting yourself to what you went through, and you held your head up with dignity, and I'm sure your wife and your children and your family are proud of you. And America and our history will remember you as being a hero for this country and for standing up for truth to power. And he even said it more eloquently than that. And the way he said it was probably even more important than the words that he said, because you may recall even during the his closing statement really hit me to the core. He also
I'm
had
so glad
a way,
you included that in the book.
Yeah. He had a way, because not enough people read it or took it to heart, at least the way I did. And it's something that I think we're missing a lot of right now in this country, thanks to Donald. We're missing empathy for one another. And I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, or I was just on doing my own podcast with Andrew Yang, you know, the Forward Party, potential third party. I don't care what party that you are. There has to be empathy and there has to be honesty. Otherwise, this experiment known as democracy is going to fall apart and fail.
I agree with you on that so much. And I want to say I do thank you for what you did. And I know, you know, from your book, you don't see yourself as a perfect person. I'm not one. None of us are. And I also want to make clear, we were joking around when we did the setup for this booked up, you know, in the promo. And I said, oh, I want to ask you about the Twizzlers at Otisville. But you and I both know it's not all cupcakes there. And I think it's important that, you know, you can make those jokes about, minimum security camp. And we all know it's not as bad as a maximum. But there were atrocious, inhuman conditions at Otisville. And I want to start with where you left off with Elijah Cummings, when you know, he touched you because he was talking about your role in your family. And I, one of the jaw-dropping parts of the book for me was how little time you were given in prison to speak on the phone to anybody. And I forgot how many minutes a month it was, but your daughter, 100, that's not much every day. What does that come down to a day?
I'm sorry. It's 300 minutes. It's 10 minutes a day.
And if you blow through those, then you don't get to talk to anyone for like 10 days.
As many days. You could blow through it in a week. And then for 3 weeks, you have no phone privilege.
And everybody
has some, again, I'm going to go to my grandma for the Yiddish, mishigas, something that's going on in their family. At that time, you know, I was dealing with a couple of things. I had a son who was graduating, from high school, just started actually college, and I had some, there was some health issues with my daughter, not to mention.
And we saw her at the sentencing or maybe at some part with crutches. It was related to that, I think.
Yeah. So my daughter had bilateral hip surgery to remove bone spurs, but that's not the, that's not the medical condition.
Issue.
No, my daughter unfortunately suffers from endometriosis,
which
is a very painful condition. It's her story really to tell. And she is very involved with the Endometriosis Foundation. And Dr. Temer Sechkin, who just did the last surgery. I mean, this poor child has had 5 surgeries in 7 years, all of which are significant. But thank God right now she's doing, really well, thanks to, the great work of Dr. Sechkin.
Could you imagine not being able to
be there for this child?
No.
She's my heart. My son is my soul. And, not to be able to be there for when they're going through rough patches in their lives, and everybody, whether it's health or not, everybody has a bad day. Everybody. And if my daughter would want to talk to me and to get into something, I couldn't do it. And that to me was torture, because I've always been the active father. And, I wasn't only just the active father to my own children. I was almost like a second father to all of my children's friends, because I was always available for them. They always come first above anything.
And let's talk. And so I hadn't really thought about this, about you and other many parents in prison. And even if people think rehabilitation is supposed to be part of what we do, can there be anything worse than family separation to this extreme? How is someone supposed to reenter society and reintegrate with their family if they have limited time talking to their family when they're locked behind bars? And there's more to talk about what else went down there. But I was also distressed by the conditions when you were in solitary, where there was no really insulation and it was freezing in the winter and 100 degrees with flies and no working toilet in the summer. I mean, what is this?
Yeah. So you're sort of conflating two different things there. First is, where I was originally set was at the Otisville Correctional Facility Satellite Camp. Nothing like what you see on television. It's more like Orange is the New Black, but there's no gates, there's no fences, there's nothing there. If you want to escape.
Oh, is that the place you could drive the car around?
I drove. I had a truck, and we used to drive around ourselves with tools, power tools. We used to play softball.
So that's the Camp Cupcake part.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Though I do want to tell you, that's the place that had no insulation. During the winters, my bed would be 40 degrees. I would sleep with 2 pairs of socks. This is not a lie. And every single inmate that's there will tell you the same thing. It's a Butler building, meaning it's aluminum over steel girders. Mm. There's no insulation at all. It really wasn't designed to be housing at first either, but it became the housing there. And I would sleep with 2 pairs of socks, thermal, my sweatpants, my regular pants, thermals t-shirt, a shirt, a sweater, my ski jacket, gloves, and a hat. That's how you had to sleep, because it's no different than if you were sleeping outdoors. It was horrific. The summers, There's no air conditioning. You would get up because you're 3,500 feet up in the air. Now, there may be people saying, well, this is what you deserve, right? You go to prison. You're not. It's not the Ritz-Carlton jerk off, right? You get what you get. Right. And I acknowledge that. There are people who, and I don't think anybody should be subjected to stuff like this. To be honest with you, the facility should at least have insulation. I mean, that's just normal, and insulation costs nothing. I didn't belong there in the first place. I ended up in prison for one simple reason, because I paid Stormy Daniels. Now, I want people, as I talk about in Revenge as well, I want people to understand, I did that at the direction of and for the benefit of Donald J. Trump. I didn't do it for my benefit. I didn't sleep with Stormy. I'm not the one who had the affair on my wife who just had a child. Instead, I became the scapegoat, the bad guy. I didn't hide the payments like Donald wanted to do with Karen McDougal. That's the Playboy playmate he was also having an affair with that I had nothing to do with. That deal was AMI, David Pecker, the National Enquirer with her. All I did is look over an agreement, a contract, to ensure that Donald was protected if, in fact, that David ended up leaving the National Enquirer, that he'd be able to then own the life rights. That's all I did. David made the 150. But the point is, in that recording that was released by Chris Cuomo, you may recall, Trump wanted to pay in cash. I wasn't paying in cash. I say, no, by check, by check. But this guy ends up getting off, and I end up basically going to prison for that. Now, people may say, well, what about your tax evasion charges? Read Revenge, all right? There was no tax evasion charges. If there was a tax omission, yes. My accountant, I had an 1,800-page per year tax return. My accountant screwed up, plain and simple. And instead of taking the responsibility for it, the Southern District of New York needed a conviction, because that's what they do. They don't prosecute anymore. They just convict. They needed it, and they must have made him some sort of a deal, which is why I am fighting every day for all the documents pursuant to FOIA. I want to just go to the second part where you are right with the broken window, with the flies, 105. As a result of COVID, they moved all of us out of the satellite camp, and they brought us to the other side, to the security side.
Okay.
And that's behind barbed wire, fences, the whole nine yards. We were placed into the EA block, and that's the area that they had brought the inmates from the Manhattan Detention Center, because they found guns and knives and phones and all sorts of stuff there, and they brought them to the EA block. Well, these guys wrecked the place. So the place was supposed to be under a complete refurbishing. They didn't. They put us there, and it was 24/7 lockup, and there was no movement at all. Nobody saw outside, nothing. All right. Then it gets even worse for me. My window, and this is when I was unconstitutionally remanded back, they put us back into EA block, or me into EA block. That now brought it up to 51 straight days of solitary confinement between the two. So it was, first it was 36 and then 15 additional days. No movement. But the second time, the room was so badly damaged. The toilet didn't work. The sink barely worked. It would trickle out water. I was missing a piece of glass from the window, so the flies would come in when it would rain at night. Again, because we were on top of the mountain, it would rain in on top of me. All I would do is ask, can I have a piece of plastic and some tape? I'll fix the window. Nope. Nope. You get nothing, right? So, you know, that whole scenario was done merely to hurt me and to punish me because I refused to waive my First Amendment constitutional right. And shame on Bill Barr. Look, I can't say shame on Donald Trump because he's just a despicable human being anyway. And, you know, we've all seen some of the antics that Trump does. But Bill Barr, to be a willing and a complicit attorney general in an unconstitutional remand, in essence making me a political prisoner in my own country, and not to ever be called on to explain what he did and why and to come clean. Instead, he thinks now by sitting and saying, oh, well, I told Donald you lost. You lost the election. I told him. Now, all of a sudden, you think you're going to be invited back into polite society, you scumbag? No.
I want to go back to the Bill Barr an election fraud part. I am so confused why the case against Donald Trump never moved forward regarding the payments that he directed that you made back to Stormy Daniels that he made to cover up the affair so it wouldn't hurt his election chances, and for which he, I think it's still within the statute of limitations, right? Because you were still getting paid back for that up and through when?
Right, through the end of December. So
this is, if Merrick Garland is listening, you know, they could charge him. So they decide not to charge Donald. And this is one of the examples of things that seem like there's a bias against you. The other thing I want to talk about I want to combine these two things together, which is after you were released from Otisville, you were planning, they were trying to get the way it works is you would get that the electronic, you know, bracelet on your ankle. And instead of doing it the normal way, they brought you down to Pearl Street, and they kind of threatened you, made you sign this, trying to get you to sign a document to give up your right to speak about anything, to publish the book you were writing. When you just asked to negotiate it, they ended up shackling you and sending you back. I'm just throwing that out there to say this is what gets me to the jaw-dropping revelation in the book. You worked with our mutual friend, now Brian's my friend, Brian Karam. He's one of the Nerd Avengers on The Mary Trump Show. And he helped ask to do some research for you to try to figure out what kind of records they had in the Department of Justice and in the FBI about your case to figure out why you were treated differently. And what stunned me was that you had made at least several FOIA requests. Mm-hmm. And one of them that you made, I just cannot believe this. This is like page 235 of the book. It's deep into the book, and they're like, no, we have nothing. But then you had
that there are there no something. Documents
yeah.
that comport with your FOIA request.
And so you thought, aha, no, I've got this one. And then suddenly they're like, oops, our bad. And they said, we have 450,000 pages. What the
000.
Fuck?
Yeah.
Whatever.
Well, 30,000 is a lot of that. Could you imagine?
Well, Michael, that's more than none. So what happened there? Why did you hire a journalist to help interview FBI agents? Can you talk a bit about that and tell me if you think that was a fruitful exercise?
Yeah. So I needed somebody like a Brian Karam, somebody that was willing to fight into the system on my behalf, because nobody would talk to me from justice. Brian was successful in getting even Judge Jed Rakoff onto the record. He managed to get former prosecutors, former and current FBI agents, because as a journalist, he has his own relationships. And through those, he was able to expand upon them and get to people who would not talk to me no matter what, simply because they know that what was done was wrong and they don't want to be a part of this. They just want to whitewash it. You did your time. You're out now. You know, suck it up, asshole. And move on. That's what was coming at me. And so I then brought on Brian in order to get the information that I needed so that I could put out an honest and truthful and a very, very explicit book, which I did, you know, in revenge that went up to, you know, number 8 on the New York Times bestsellers list. What was happening, though, is we wanted additional documents, and the ones that you refer to. And when they said no, that there are no documents that are responsive to your FOIA request, we brought on Mark Zaid, who is an attorney.
Right.
And Mark is probably one of the 5 foremost lawyers that handle these FOIA requests. And it was as a result of Mark's filing that we were then told that, oops, right, me bad. It's not zero, it's 480,000. But then they asked us to limit our search, which we did. And then there was still like 40,000 documents or so. But then they said, well, because it's so many, we can only give you 500 documents a month. Well, that would still take about 9 years, as opposed to the other way, which would be 90 years. in order to get all the documents. Now, this is an interesting thing about government, too. Government is not designed to be assistive. It's not designed to provide you with the documentation to hold those accountable who should be held accountable. Instead, it's designed to protect itself. And so Mark, with the filings, the court determined that, and it was by the FOIA office, that we will be starting and giving you 500 pages as of August 22nd of this year, 2022. Well, August 22 comes, and of course, August 22 then goes. And so the following day, August 23, Mark gets a letter, which he sends around, you know, like I said, great lawyer, sends around that says, the documents that we were going to send to you have method and process of other government agencies. And before we can send them to you, we need to show it to them for their additional redactions so as not to interfere with their process. Okay. September 22 comes around. Still nothing. September 23, right? And I'm not talking about the year. I'm talking about the date. Around. And we still haven't gotten anything from August. Same letter for September. Same for October. Same for November. The same bullshit. Over and over. I can't get a damn document from them. And Mark is going back in again to court on a status conference, and he's going to implore the judge within which to sanction them, fine them, you know, hold them in contempt if they don't start to comply. I don't have a
single... And what is the area that you're looking for information on? Is it just the same stuff about what went down with the remand or something else?
All of the communications that took place between... Remember, so, and if I can just give you a quick overview to those that
Please
may
do.
Not know. So when you leave the facility based upon what I was released for, which was COVID, because of my comorbidities, you are put on what's called furlough. And on furlough, you're basically free to do and to go wherever you want. And that gives the system an opportunity to get the paperwork to where it needs to go so that you can then be given a date for monitoring for an ankle bracelet. And I ultimately, after a week or so or 2 weeks, I ultimately got that date. And so then I was contacted by a residential reentry management system that has been doing this for the BOP for many years. Called GEO, and I was supposed to go up to the Bronx, and I had met a gentleman.
Just to give the time frame, we're talking May 2020 is when you get out.
Correct.
Okay, good.
All right. And this gentleman shows up to my home to look around to make sure everything is fine. And I'm all set the following day or so to 2 days later to go. When the following day, I get a phone call from a gentleman by the name, I shouldn't call him a gentleman, I should call him an asshole, Adam Pakula, who works for the Department of Corrections. And I write about him in the book. And he's like the lowest level. His supervisor is a woman by the name of Enid Phoebus, who has since retired and moved down to Florida. And Pakula tells me that you're not going to the Bronx tomorrow. You're coming to 500 Pearl Street, which is the criminal courthouse. And I said, why? I already met with the gentleman from the RRM Center, from GEO, and I'm due to go there at 9 o'clock in the morning and fill out the paperwork like everybody else. And he says to me, every now and then we pull, and that's when I knew he was full of shit. Every now and then we pull a file for, you know, our own evaluation purposes and so on. And then we, you need to come to us. It didn't sit right with me. So I asked a friend of mine, since we were in junior high school, who happens to be a lawyer. His name's Jeff Levine. I said, hey, Jeff, do me a favor. Come with me. This doesn't seem right. Because now there's an argument going on between GEO and Pakula as to where I'm supposed to go. And the guy from GEO said to me, he's been doing this like 39 years. And in his 39 years, he has never seen this happen. So Jeff comes with me. We go there. I meet with Pakula and Phoebus in the office. Neither of them wearing the, you know, face masks or anything. We are, they hand me, a two-page document. Now, I've been around the system enough to know that all federal documents are basically old, that they have
federal ID numbers
at the bottom that distinguish them. It's like the F2 form, F5 form. Everything has a number attached to a letter and a number attached to it. This did not. It was a 2-page clean, word perfectly printed document that had 9 demands that I had to agree with. Well, the very first one is that I would not speak to the media, that I would not speak to any press, do no television, no radio. I would not do a television show of my own. I would not start a podcast. I would not publish a book. I would not, speak to anybody regarding, you know, anything. But not only was I prohibited from this, but so was my family, all family members, and my friends. Otherwise,
and these were the condition. These were listed as a condition for you to be able to get this ability to be released.
Correct.
Okay.
And so Jeff and I look at each other, and you know, we both say, the first one is really difficult, considering my book is already with a publisher and it's already
and
out.
That book was Betrayal.
That was called Disloyal.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Disloyal. Sorry.
Right. So what ends up happening is, they turn around and they say, well, let's go through the other 2 through 9. And some of them were really not fair either, but I didn't care. We both said, hey, look, is there a way to temp down this language? First of all, I can't tell friends what to do, right? I'm going to be in home confinement. It's not right that you're including my family, right? And I already have a book, which I know you're aware of, which is why I said, so I know that this was created by Bill Barr. So the next time you speak to him, please tell him I say hello. They then turn around and said, why don't you two wait in the hallway? And we're going to reach out to our superiors and see if we can't, you know, temp down this language a little bit to make it more palatable. Great. And I had my son waiting for me in front with the car to take me back to the apartment.
And what are you thinking then? Are you worried? Are you thinking this
is... At first, not at all. We're just sitting watching New York One on television, and we're wondering what's taking so long. 30 minutes goes by, 45 minutes goes by. I asked if I could use the phone to call my son because now it's about lunchtime, and I said, you know, look, this is going to take a while.
They took your phone away from you to call.
Correct.
In
the federal courthouse, they take your phones.
Right.
What ends up then happening is... we knock on the door. I call my son. I tell him it's going to take a while. Go grab yourself some lunch. Another 30 minutes thereafter, we're still waiting. And lo and behold, as we're watching, talking about that, this doesn't make sense. Something is really wrong here. There's 3 men standing over me, one bigger than the other, holding handcuffs and shackles. And they turn and Mr. Cohen, stand up and face the wall. Well, not only did I turn white, but so did my buddy Jeff. And it was horrific. They then took me, handcuffed, shackled me, paraded me around back door, indoor, up door. I fell on myself 2-3 times because the shackles are really heavy with your hands, you know, also bound. Put me in a car. Then they were taking me somewhere. Then they take me out of the car. Then they end up putting me in a cell, which was like a freezer. It had to be, honestly, maybe 30, 40 degrees or something like that. And all I'm wearing is a thin jumpsuit now with just socks. And the jumpsuit is too small, so you can't even fully cover yourself. It's so cold.
And can I
interject
right now, while this is all going on, the public is being fed a line of bull saying that it's because you went to dinner at a restaurant outside your home, which was not even forbidden, right? This is
exactly what... Correct. That's exactly correct. That was put out by the New York Post. Obviously, it was done in tandem with others, meaning the Trump media team. Disappointed that the Post would even do something, you know, like that. Though, you know, we've seen some pretty horrific stuff that had come out, you know, in that paper. But this was front page. They really blew this thing up. It was an absolute and a complete lie. Then
the truth comes out, but...
Well, then, and by the way, the sickest thing is that each and every time that we would question the veracity of the Post's reporting, they would turn around and they would put it in another article, and then another article and another. They refused to acknowledge that they were wrong. So to this day, they still have it.
Let's go back to, so then you're, I want to go back to the,
so
what
I was telling
next.
You that I'm yeah. sitting in, I'm in this cell. It's got to be about 40 degrees. It is ice cold in there. I'm by myself. There's the vent, which runs the entire length of the ceiling, is just blowing, is cold air, and it's blowing it hard. And I can't stay warm. And after like 20 minutes in there, you're so cold, especially it's blowing on the top of your head. So I'm knocking on the door. Finally, a guy comes and says, can I just get like a blanket or a sweatshirt or something? I'm freezing in here. My face is blue. My lips are blue. I'm chattering so hard. I truly thought my teeth were going to fall out of my mouth. Mm. And, you know, then they left me in there for a little over 2-3 hours or so until they finally take me out. And I see two individuals that looked very familiar right now. And, you know, I'm starving. I hadn't eaten all day. I'm frozen to death. I'm dizzy as can be. I can't believe what's going on here. I'm supposed to be at home with my family on home confinement, which I shouldn't have even been on in the first place, considering, again, there was no tax evasion. There was no misrepresentation to a bank. That was another fucking lie by First Republic. Not true at all. You know, and here I am now, freezing to death, dizzy, feeling sick as a dog. And I see these two guys, and then they're calling my name to come there. So I walk over, and they're like, and then I realize that they're from Otisville, and they were summoned by Otisville to come to 500 Pearl in order to bring me back to Otisville, to which they did from there that night, because I got in about 15 minutes after count, so that you can't go into even EA block. Rather, you have to go to the SHU, to solitary confinement, which is even worse. And then the next morning, they ended up transferring me to the EA block and into that cell that was completely destroyed and in major, major need of repairs.
And then, fortunately, somehow, how quickly did your lawyer get this before a judge? Because you were out of there pretty quick.
Well, pretty quick. 15 days of solitary confinement.
Oh,
I challenge anybody to do one day. You know, it wasn't quick at all. So my wife had found, and fortunately, an attorney by the name of Danya Perry, brilliant, brilliant attorney, criminal attorney. And I spent some time talking to her about the case. And it took about, I would say, 10 days for the writ to be prepared, the motion to be prepared for my release based upon a violation of my constitutional rights. ACLU and another organization joined on as well, doing amicus briefs, you know, expressing the outrage of the violation of a citizen's rights, based upon the unwillingness to waive to waive any constitutional right. And so Judge Alvin K. Hellerstein was chosen by the spinning of the wheel. And at that time, they had the hearing. Judge Hellerstein, after a very short period of time, like 30 or so minutes, made his ruling from the bench that this is retaliatory of the most disgraceful nature by the executive branch, by Bill Barr and, you know, by Trump, and demanded the immediate release of me post a COVID test the next morning. And the next day, you know, 24 hours from the time that Alvin K. Hellerstein demanded that I be released, they literally held me to 30 minutes before the expiration of that 24 hour, just to hold me, because that's
right,
what they were
because
told.
They could.
And yeah. It goes back to the FOIA request. I want all the communications between the Southern District of New York, between a guy named Patrick McFarlane, who's the reentry manager over at MDC, to his higher ups, all the way up to as far as it goes, which again, I believe would be Bill Barr. It wouldn't be Donald because he never used email, but I wanted all of those communications. Unfortunately, to date, despite wonderful Congress members like Hakeem Jeffries, Ted Lieu, Carolyn Maloney, Eric Swalwell. We also have Congressman Steve Cohen, no relation, by the way, and Senator Dick Durbin. Each and every one of them have made requests for documents, and so far, not one of us have received a single page. That's supposed to tell you something about how the system is running.
How different do you think your life would have been if Donald had kept paying your legal fees and hadn't thrown you under the bus? Do you think at some point there would have been a break? Or do you think you would have just been one of these people trying to cringing while you just tried to distance yourself from him?
You know, it's a great question, one that I get asked a lot. I would have continued to fight the allegations. And again, if in fact that Trump and his cohorts had not decided to use me as their scapegoat to distance Donald and to deflect from Donald, I don't believe that there would have been the charges of tax evasion or misrepresentation to a bank. I just don't, because there was none and there still is no data within which to validate that. In fact, I even showed the pre-sentencing individual for Judge William H. Pauley III, who knew right off the bat that he was going to sentence me because, as what I suspect, you know, he's from an area that no Jews are allowed, and he probably wanted to brag to many of his country club friends, hey, look what I did to this Cohen guy, not to mention he is a staunch Republican. I don't believe that had Donald continued to pay on the representation that these charges would have been launched against me. Now,
well, don't you think he would have pardoned you, though, too?
I mean, 100%. Look at the people. If I would have, yeah. 100, I would have been the first one on the pardon. And that's something that a lot of the my fellow inmates used to rib me about, including many of the correctional officers, that they would say to me, you know, you're fucking stupid. Had you done nothing, had you said nothing, provided no testimony, no cooperation, no documents, you would have been the first one pardoned. And so you would have done the same time that you're doing now, but you would come out like everybody else and it would all be over. No more felony conviction. You could do what you want.
But why didn't you?
Because, as I said to George Stephanopoulos on that interview, once I realized what was really going on here and how Donald, you know, had thrown me under the bus, one thing that I said is that I will never allow history to remember me as the villain of Donald's story, and that my first loyalty, something that I misdirected for way too many years, despite, and I write about it in Revenge, despite the constant badgering by my wife, my daughter, and my son to quit Trump. I didn't need to work for Trump. I talk about that in the book too. I retired when I was 39. I could not have lived on my Trump salary. That was just bonus, you know, bonus money. I had done very well for myself. And now, you know, as I say to people, I'm not a rags to riches story. Donald didn't make Michael Cohen. In fact, Donald Trump destroyed Michael Cohen. And I am not the rags to riches story that people want to make for their own whatever.
Do you think it's because
I'm a riches to rags story.
Do you think it was not just, I mean, do you think it was because when you met him, you were young, you had just had a pretty close brush with a scary medical condition? Maybe he was with a father that, figure. I mean, what do you think loyal?
No. Under no circumstance would I ever consider Donald to be a replacement for my father. I mean, first of all, my dad's 87. I'm incredibly fortunate to have both my parents.
A blessing.
My dad, who's a Holocaust survivor. Yeah, Kanahara is right. You know, my dad being a Holocaust survivor, he is incredibly sweet and sensitive and kind. I wouldn't trade my father for anyone, least of all Donald, anyone. But I did look up to Donald. Donald was a celebrity. He was a sort of a Renaissance guy, right? He had the number one book that was out there, The Art of the Deal. He had the number one television show.
I read that
when
it came out.
Me too. 1987. On top of that, we were building buildings all over the place. He had made me co-president of Trump Productions. On top of that, he put me on the board, and it was just Donald, Alan Weisselberg, and myself on behalf of the Miss Universe organization. I mean, I was really given a lot of authority,
like a lot of responsibility, access, fun. Yeah, I get you.
And fun. And, you know, there were a lot of stupid shit went on at the office, but there was also a lot of fun times. I had a lot of very good colleagues. We had really good times, good camaraderie. But then again, as things progressed, things got pushed a little farther down the line, right? And then you start to overstep doing certain things that you're capable of doing. And I was more capable than clearly most in terms of dealing and fixing, you know, Donald's multitude of problems. It's kind of why I started this company called Crisis X, which I do, but it's really only of the highest level of nonsense. Not like your kid gets a DUI and I need a lawyer. I'm talking about like really difficult stuff that needs fixing. But Donald always took it past the point of where it needed to go. And that's what made it dirty and ugly, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that brings me, I think we're going to be kind of having to close our conversation soon. So that brings me to something that you're kind of alluding to, which is you're quite honest in your book, In Revenge. And you talk about, you said that you threatened over 500 people for Donald, you know, maybe around contracts or what have you. It also, I think you included in that the people who have over the years said they were going to release his college transcripts or his SAT scores. And so I wondered, is there anything you can share with me about what you know about his grades or his SAT scores?
Well, so way to go, Jen. No, nobody asks a question like you, my friend. And there's so much more to this story, which is why I actually wrote Revenge. And yes, it is honest and it's truthful, just like Disloyal, because readers can see through bullshit. And it's like why if you take a look at like Jeffrey Berman's book, it shouldn't even be a consideration. Even John Bolton's book. What a bunch of self-aggrandizing nonsense. All right. You know, and the reader could read right through it. Truth also is I didn't have a reason to lie, right, about anything, because I've already put it out there. I put it out there when trying to defend myself in this criminal case that I had no shot at winning because Judge Pauly had already predetermined. And when I went and showed him documents, they didn't even want to hear it. They actually told me that if I tried to use these documents, it could cost me another 10 years because it would bump up the points. And that I wouldn't be able...
Oh, this is a document about paying back the taxes?
No. I'm talking about documents like copies of checks that showed everything went to Capital One Bank and that I gave every document to my accountant to reconcile bank books and so on. But going back to your question, yes, when I say I threaten people 500 times, right? And that's the famous meme that you see out there. 100 more, 200 more, 500? Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah, when you send a letter an individual or an institution of, in this case, it was Penn, it was Fordham, it was NYMA, New York Military Academy, and the Scholastic Achievement Boards, and so on. I consider that as part of the threat, though I didn't go there and meet with the president of the school with a baseball bat or a 12-gauge and say, if you release it, I'm going to blow your kneecaps off. That's the way Avenatti and the press wanted to make it. Salacious, dirty, fun, you know, John Wickish, right?
So you sent a lawyer's letter is what you're saying.
Correct. Threatening that if you violate the law, and it is the law that you cannot release these records without an individual's express written permission, that we will take all necessary and available legal action under law against you, right? That's a threat. And I did that to multiple schools and so on. But I also did that to, you know, to newspapers and magazines and to media individuals that were making allegations against Trump that were either gross distortions, misstatements, or just blatant lies. So, yes, those I did. Now, everybody- everybody will recall, and it's the only one that you have, and it's the only one that you'll ever have, is my conversation with, and now he's on NPR, this guy, Tim Mak, the reporter. And I apologized for, you know, my usage of language and how the conversation went. Something that people completely ignore, because again, it's not the salacious, dirty, you know, angry type that people like Avenatti just kept throwing out there, and Tim Mak did it as well. He sent an email to Hope Hicks that he's writing an article about Donald Trump raping Ivana in 1991. And as I wrote in the apology, it's not true. All right, he never raped Ivana. Not in 91, not ever. And more than that, really hurt not just the children, but the grandchildren who are old enough to understand, you know, that this is grandpa and they were going to make a whole thing about it. And so I tried to get Tim Mak not to do the story. And of course, you know, I would say anything in order to deflect off of it. And I said, well, you can't rape your wife, right? And so on. But what, which I knew not to be accurate, but it didn't matter. My law, goal was to get him to change his mind and not do it.
Got you.
You know, friend who was raped many, many years ago. And I know how it's affected her life. And having a wife who I love dearly, having a daughter who's my life, having sisters and female cousins and so on, I started to put myself into, I projected myself into this picture. And I detest rapists, as everybody should. And the notion that he would send it to this young girl, Hope Hicks, making this false allegation about Donald, I lost my head. And that should
look,
not.
Look, I'm really glad that you were willing to even bring that up now. I was just actually trying to find out how bad Donald's grades are, but I appreciate that
I'm gonna give you the answer real quick. But yeah. Please continue.
Yeah, but I appreciate that you are. That you're willing to talk about something that you're not proud of. I think that there's not one person, especially a lawyer, who hasn't, you know, used their rhetorical muscle or pressured people in a way. And it's just the, you know, you, especially when you have a client who has created that environment for you.
I mean, the self-righteousness of so many people, like, whoa, did you hear what you said to Tim Mak? Really? Why? Because every conversation you've ever had with everyone in your entire life has just been so beautiful and perfect. Only if you're Donald Trump, it's beautiful. It's perfect. It was a perfect conversation. Now, just going really quickly to his grades. I have never seen the grades. So, you know, I have heard from people like his sister and from others who say that they certainly knew his grades. And it was a constant issue in his home. You know, my understanding is that he did extremely poorly at Fordham, but Daddy Fred bought him into University of Pennsylvania. You know, there's allegations that he went to Wharton, that that's where his dad bought him a spot into. I'm not sure if he did go to Wharton or he went to Penn. I haven't been able to verify one way or the other. But the interesting thing is how he lies and says that he was the top of his class. He was not. And that all you have to do is look up the yearbook and you'll see that he was not. according to, again, his sister, his grades weren't even passing. And that, you know, and that is why, of course, he did not want any of these grades to be exposed, because he could then no longer say, I'm really a smart guy. I have a big brain.
So that
I have good words. I know good words.
This is going to bring me to my very last question, which is, do you know when the last time you were in contact with him, with Donald directly, and do you think you'll ever hear from him again?
So the answer to that is I do remember. It was the day of the raid. I reached out to the White House after I went and I replaced my cell phone, which was taken by the FBI. Pursuant to that raid, I then got, you know, I got another cell phone and I called the White House and I left message and he called me back and he said to me, he was, you know, He's a great actor. I have to be honest with you. He should have been an actor, not a politician or a businessman, because nobody could lay on the bullshit as good as he. I can't believe that they, I'm sorry. And so I ultimately realized it was sort of like a Count of Monte Cristo type of realization that he knew all along this raid was coming. There's no way in the world that the FBI was going to raid the home, the hotel, the law office of the personal attorney to the president of the United States without notifying the president, especially as the president was Donald. And he doesn't take well to these type of surprises. And so when he sat there and said, oh, I'm disgusted that they raided one of my lawyers' homes, all of a sudden, I don't have a name. That's part of the distance and deflection of Donald.
Right.
So
right.
That's when I had heard from him for the very last time. Now, there were people that tried to intercede on his behalf and say, you know, hey, Donald's thinking about it, like this guy, Bob Costello, through Rudy Giuliani, you know, stay right. The course. Let me be part of your team. That was also that they could relay back message to him in terms of what I'm disclosing and whether I'm staying loyal to, right, to,
right.
You know, Diaper Donald or not, which, of course, I realized very, very quickly, and I cut myself off from all of them. Now, as far as do I think I'll ever hear from him again, it's almost as doubtful as him developing a conscience.
Or him right? coming on the podcast, right? Writing a book so he can come on the podcast.
Yeah, or reading the book or what have you. He doesn't read. But it's almost as improbable as him developing a conscience and thinking more about any one person in this world above himself.
Okay, I said it was the last question, but this is really the last one. You've been right about so many things. You said he was not going to want to leave office. I mean, I could go on and on about the things. Do you think he will actually be indicted in the next 6 months?
Oh, yeah, I believe it'll be way before 6 months. I do really believe that this Matt Colangelo has no choice. You know, to bring him in and not do anything, I think would be political suicide to Alvin Bragg. On top of that, Tish James. Right. And I always refer to the
what about this new special counsel? Who's going to go first? Who's going to indict first?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the answer because I don't know, you know, the timeline. I would think that it would be Jack Smith. But the nice part is that, of course, you know, the two cases are bifurcated. They're not one. And I believe that the documents, the improperly documents at Mar-a-Lago is probably the easiest case out there to prove. Yep. It's a simple case. By the way, if it was you, me, or any of your listeners that had taken a single document, the charge and the repercussion would be so significant that it would even make Reality Winner's 5-year despicable sentence, right? It would make it look like child's play. And I believe that Jack Smith will go and very quickly on the Mar-a-Lago raid and the document case. I also believe that Tish James had referred to the Southern District of New York and to the IRS criminal prosecution requests for taxes and so on. I also believe that this guy, Matt Colangelo at the DA, has all the documents that he needs. And again,
and Georgia.
And Georgia, I think, is the toughest of them all. I don't think that he gets indicted or convicted from Georgia because it goes to mens rea, his state of mind. And he'll say, I believe that the election was stolen from me. And I believe that it was stolen out of Georgia. And this is my opinion. And I'm entitled to it, right or wrong. And that my intent was not, you know, to get them to make up votes or steal. It's a mens rea case. And Donald, who we all know lies with impunity, will lie on the stand for that. So I think it's these other matters that will ultimately be his downfall. And to be honest with you, I can't wait for the orange-crusted Mandarin Mussolini to be given his oranges and, you know, I mean, I'm talking about his orange jumpsuit and somehow a photo to get out because they all deserve it. They're all destroying our democracy. And I will tell you one thing in final closing. I'm really proud of the Gen Z group, and I'm really proud of Americans who are listening to people like yourself, myself, Midas, Lincoln Project, and so many others, because what was supposed to be a devastating red wave turned out to be more of a blue wave, right? And the fact that we even picked up a seat in the Senate, I mean, it's the first time since the mid-1930s that a president, you know, not only kept the House, but also added. It just goes to show you that people are listening, that democracy is really important and sitting in the back of people's minds, because as an experiment, which democracy is, if you lose it, like women have now lost, you know, the decision of Roe, you know, to make their own decisions with their body, I'm not sure how you ever get it back, at least not in our lifetime. It's easy. You know, you work very hard to get these rights and you work very hard to keep them. But once they're lost, like the Roe decision, it's nearly impossible to get back. So we do have to be careful. And that's what revenge is all about. It's giving you the playbook on what Trump and his minions were up to in order to try to destroy the Constitution, destroy our democracy, and take control over this country as an autocracy, a monarchy, a dictatorship, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, for speaking with me today. And everyone should go out and get a copy of Revenge. I really learned so much. And thank you for the suggestions about reforming the Justice Department as well.
Good to see you, Jen.
Wow, that was an incredible conversation with Michael Cohen. We covered so much ground that it's really hard to admit that I didn't get to ask him everything I wanted to. What I was hoping that we could also get into a little bit is the process of doing the research for this book. As Michael mentioned, he worked with journalist Brian Karam to find out what the agents who'd worked on the case at the FBI, some folks at the Justice Department, and others really thought about it. And what's really great about Revenge is we do hear about, or we do get to read, accounts from FBI agents and others off the record about their suspicions about unfairness that went on in his case. But what I also didn't get to ask him about are the praiseworthy things he said about the folks in the Department of Justice. He did spend some time here talking about what happened when Bill Barr was in charge and his suspicions that Donald Trump was calling many of the shots when it came to throwing him under the bus and what he believes was unfair treatment by the legal system. But there's a lot in the book, too, as I mentioned, that talks about the good folks there who helped him out. I did mention some of the jaw-dropping revelations in the book, and I just want to emphasize one of them again. That was the way prisoners are treated in terms of their ability to speak to the outside world. Maybe it's something you haven't thought about because prison, you might believe, is supposed to be simply a punishment or a deterrent. But actually, the justification for incarcerating people in our system is that we'll also offer to them some kind of rehabilitation and help them so they can return and integrate themselves back into the community and be a productive member of the community, not a, you know, parasite or someone who commits crimes. And it seems to me that separating a person from their family, not just physically, but in terms of being able to get on the telephone and speak with them, connect with their children, their spouses, their relatives, their friends, is the opposite of rehabilitation. I think being disconnected is alienating. I think it's lonely. I think it creates bitterness. And I really wish that were something that could change about the legal system. Some of the other things that I didn't get to fully discuss with Michael are the details around the pleas that he entered into. He talks about things like tax evasion, and he briefly touched on the elections fraud allegations. But we kind of jumped very quickly through the way in which he was told about the specific charges in the very short time frame that he was given in order to either enter a plea or be arrested and with his wife also, and, you know, and perp walked. And we didn't get into that in detail. So I'm hoping that, again, if you get a chance to read the book, that you will take a look at that. And finally, I was incredibly touched, and still am, by the kindness that Representative Elijah Cummings showed to Michael when he was a witness before Congress, and also the fact that, as we learn from the book, that he actually called him on the phone to thank him for his service. It's a complicated situation to be a former felon, someone who has admitted that they have done not great things and regret them, but also to, on balance, gotten the truth out there and have tried to make a difference and have, I believe, has, I believe, made an incredible difference in what's to come. I can say with certainty that if it weren't for Michael Cohen's cooperating with the Manhattan DA, we would not have had even the conviction this week of Donald Trump's businesses or what is to come, which I believe will be both an indictment from the Manhattan DA related to bank fraud and insurance fraud, related to overvaluing and undervaluing assets, you know, to service purposes in ways that violate New York law. And I also think there are going to be related federal charges out of the Southern District of New York. And I, you know, again, Michael is, as he's admitted, not a perfect person, but none of us are. And so I just want to take this moment again to, you know, say thank you for listening and to thank Michael for coming on Book Talk.